America Looks Abroad. This is the 51st in a series of broadcasts presented by the staff members of the Foreign Policy Association, a nonpartisan organization which offers accurate information on world affairs. Today's subject is the outlook in the Far East, and the speaker is Mr. T.A. Bisson, Research Associate of the Foreign Policy Association. Mr. Bisson.
Good afternoon. Headlines during the past week have kept attention focused on a series of important developments in Europe, while a crisis brewing in the Far East has been almost overlooked. Hitler's conferences at Berlin with Soviet Premier and Foreign Commissar Molotov on Tuesday and Wednesday easily held the center of the stage. As the Berlin meetings were taking place, news of last Monday night's successful British air raid on the Italian naval base at Taranto was released from London. Along with this crippling blow at the Italian fleet has gone continued Greek military successes on the Albanian frontier and the strengthening of British naval and aviation centers in Greek territory. On the whole, it has been a black week for Italy, the blackest of the war thus far. Against this background of European events, the possibility of a new and fateful crisis was emerging in the Far East. Japanese troops and transports were being concentrated on the northern edge of the South China Sea in apparent preparation for a southward drive. Three main points of concentration were reported: Haiphong, chief seaport of Indochina; Guangzhou, site of a French leasehold on China's southern coast; and Hainan Island, occupied by Japan nearly 2 years ago. This movement had begun late last month, when Japanese forces withdrew from Nanning, capital of Guangxi province in South China. Since then, the Japanese command has evacuated the rest of this province and parts of neighboring Guangdong province, and Chinese troops have reoccupied the entire area. Vigorous Chinese counterattacks, in fact, started well before the withdrawal began and undoubtedly hastened the Japanese decision to carry out this strategic retreat. Nanning, it should be noted, was the first provincial capital to be reoccupied by Chinese forces since the Sino-Japanese War began in 1937. The event has given a solid boost to Chinese morale. When the Guangxi evacuation occurred, reports indicated that the Japanese forces thus made available were to be used for a further move into southeastern Asia. As their numbers seemed too few for a large-scale operation, these reports were generally discounted. Now, however, it appears that additional Japanese troops are being withdrawn from central China to join those evacuated from the southern province of Guangxi. It is reported that Japanese troops are moving south from points throughout the Yangtze Valley, including Nanking and Hankou, thus reducing the garrisons, but not amounting to an evacuation, of these and other cities. The size of this Japanese concentration in China's southern waters is sufficient to indicate that an important move may be in preparation. The objective most commonly suggested is Saigon, the largest city on Indochina's southeastern coast. In this area lies the naval base at Camran Bay, which would be of great strategic value in Japanese hands as a jumping-off place for a further advance into Southeast Asia, either against the Dutch East Indies or British Malaya. From Saigon, also, there runs the shortest and best motor road into Siam. In addition, there have been reports that Siamese troops concentrated on Indochina's borders may act in conjunction with a Japanese thrust at Saigon. Two further facts are of interest in this situation. Inspired Japanese dispatches have claimed that anti-Japanese agitation is occurring in the Saigon area. It is also alleged that the local French authorities at Saigon are determined to resist Japan and are opposed to the conciliatory policy of Admiral Decoux, Governor General of Indochina, and a supporter of the Vichy government. If these reports are true, the Japanese might have to take Saigon by military-naval assault. If not, they might possibly again induce the French authorities in Indochina to agree to a peaceful occupation of the area. That significant events are again pending in the Far East was further indicated by the holding of another imperial conference at Tokyo last Tuesday. These important conferences of the highest Japanese military and civil officials, held in the presence of the emperor, used to occur hardly once in a decade. They always deal with some grave emergency, but under the present Japanese cabinet, they seem to have become almost routine. The last one, you may recall, was held on September 19th, when the terms of Japan's alliance with the Axis powers, announced several days later, were approved. What may have been considered at this second conference? After Tuesday's meeting, the cabinet secretary announced that the Imperial Conference had reached a complete agreement of views on problems relating to China. Tokyo dispatches amplify this cryptic statement. They suggest that the conference may have approved a treaty which has been under negotiation for many months with Wang Jingwei, head of the Japanese-sponsored regime at Nanking. The conference might also have approved plans for military naval action in the South China Sea, if such action is being contemplated. Aggressive action by Japan and Southeast Asia under the existing circumstances would be likely to precipitate an immediate crisis in the Pacific. Since the end of September, the United States, supported by Great Britain, has pursued a twofold policy in the Far East. On the one hand, this country and Great Britain have delivered a warning to Japan. This warning has taken the form of an embargo on American scrap iron shipments, official advice to American and British nationals in Eastern Asia to return home, the reopening of the Burma Road, and conversations between American, British, and Australian officials regarding defense matters in the Pacific. On the other hand, an attempt has been made to keep the door open to negotiations for a settlement with Japan. On September 28th, the day after Japan signed the pact with the Axis powers, Undersecretary of State Sumner Wells made a public plea for such an approach to the Far Eastern problem. During the past week, despite Japan's apparent preparations for drastic action, there have been continued efforts at conciliation. Last Sunday, Joseph C. Grew, American ambassador at Tokyo, held a lengthy conference with the Japanese foreign minister, Yosuke Matsuoka. This conference is understood to have been marked by an extremely friendly atmosphere, and the possibility of a new effort to improve Japanese-American relations was seen as its result. On Monday, the American ambassador represented the foreign diplomats at an imperial reception in Tokyo, which commemorated the traditional date of the founding of Japan. Speaking for the diplomats, the American ambassador declared, "This anniversary marks and symbolizes the long continuity of history and tradition for which Japan is deservedly distinguished. May Your Majesty's people prosper, and may this nation ever increasingly contribute to the general culture and well-being of mankind." Emperor Hirohito was said to have nodded vigorously as if in approval of this speech, and on Tuesday, the court circular reported that His Majesty appeared greatly pleased with Mr. Grew's message. A more practical gesture of goodwill toward Japan appeared on Wednesday when the details of an oil agreement between the Dutch East Indies and Japan were announced at Batavia. Under the terms of this agreement, Japan's supplies of petroleum and gasoline obtained from the East Indies would rise from 494,000 tons a year to 1,800,000 tons. British, Dutch, and American interests control the oil fields and plants in the islands. Anglo-American approval of the arrangement was seen in the fact that United States and British companies would act as agents in supplying the oil to the Japanese interests. Replying to criticism of this deal in the House of Commons, the British Undersecretary of Foreign Affairs, Richard Austin Butler, declared that the agreement had not been finally signed. The detailed nature of the report seemed to indicate, however, that the terms have been settled, and the expected signature remains a mere formality. At Washington, Undersecretary of State Sumner Wells declared to newspaper men on Friday that the agreement did not frustrate any American policy, the reference apparently being to the embargo on shipment of aviation gasoline outside this hemisphere. During the past week, news correspondents and editorial writers have manifested an intense interest in another important aspect of the Far Eastern situation, that of Soviet-Japanese relations. The conferences between the Soviet Premier and Chancellor Hitler at Berlin, as well as the recent arrival of a new Japanese ambassador at Moscow, have given rise to reports that a Soviet-Japanese agreement, possibly taking the form of a non-aggression pact, is in the offing. Speculation has been rife as to what the terms of such an agreement might be. The crucial question has been whether the Soviet Union would agree to abandon the aid which it has been rendering China. During recent years, this aid has taken on sizable proportions. The USSR has advanced large credits to China, several times greater than those given by any other country. And the Chinese government has utilized these credits for the purchase of considerable amounts of Soviet heavy munitions, notably airplanes. In addition, the Soviet Union has sharply curtailed its trade relations with Japan. From a total of nearly 53 million yen in 1936, the Soviet-Japanese trade turnover has continuously declined. Until last year, it amounted to only a little over 600,000 yen, or about $150,000. Is it possible that this policy is about to be reversed with the signing of a Soviet-Japanese pact? No indication has yet been given of what may have been said on this subject during the Molotov-Hitler conversations at Berlin. The Berlin communique of last Thursday was as noncommittal as most such documents. It merely stated that agreement had been reached on all questions of importance that are of interest to Germany and the Soviet Union. Other information suggests that Premier Molotov is returning to Moscow with Hitler's proposals, but made no commitments at Berlin. On Friday, however, the official Soviet news agency TASS denied reports that Japan had reached an agreement with the Soviet Union, outlining spheres of influence in the Far East and providing for cessation of Soviet aid to the Chinese government at Chongqing. The TASS statement asserted that these reports do not correspond to reality. It is perhaps significant that the TASS statement does not flatly deny the possibility of any form of Soviet-Japanese agreement. It merely excludes an agreement defining spheres of influence in Asia or carrying a Soviet pledge to cease aiding China. A pact might yet be signed which covered specifically Soviet-Japanese issues, such as trade matters or the fisheries question, or by which the Soviet Union might declare its neutrality in case Japan became involved in war in Southeast Asia. It remains to be seen whether such a pact will soon be announced. Meanwhile, the immediate course of developments in the Far East is likely to turn on the use to which Tokyo puts the forces that are being concentrated off China's southern coasts. If the decision is for another forward move, possibly against Saigon and southern Indochina, a severe crisis is almost certain to result. Preparations to meet such a contingency are obviously being made. Last Wednesday, it was announced in London that further reinforcements had reached the Far East, although their numbers or the types of additional equipment that may have accompanied them were not specified. At the same time, a new British post, Commander-in-Chief in the Far East, was created, and Air Chief Marshal Sir Robert Brooke Popham was assigned to this newly established command, with headquarters at Singapore. His territory covers Singapore, Malaya, Burma, and Hong Kong. The appointment has been made, according to the official London statement, quote, in view of the stage which has been reached in defense dispositions in the territories in the Far East, for the protection of which the British government is responsible, and in order to ensure coordinated control. The extent to which recent Anglo-American-Australian conversations have provided for a possible coordinated defense against a Japanese advance in this region is not known. Further developments in this matter are expected when Lord Lothian, the British ambassador, returns to Washington. It is generally understood, however, that Britain has offered to make fleet facilities in the area, including the Singapore base, available to the United States. During the past month, the American fleet, now stationed at Hawaii, has been refitted in successive contingents on the Pacific coast, while the men have been given shore leave. The third and last of these contingents reached San Pedro on Thursday, and according to the announced schedule, will not return to Hawaii for several weeks. This interval must be regarded as pregnant with critical possibilities in the Far East.
Mr. T.A. Bisson, Research Associate of the Foreign Policy Association, was today's speaker in the series America Looks Abroad. Beginning next Sunday, this program will be heard at 2:15 Eastern Standard Time over most of these stations. We invite you to tune in at that time to hear another speaker in the America Looks Abroad series. This is the National Broadcasting Company, RCA Building, Radio City, New York.